This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, you're listening to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashran Johan. The Sarawak state elections nominations took place a couple of days ago. A record number of 349 candidates are contesting 82 seats in Malaysia's largest state. Now, multi-cornered fights are happening in all but four constituencies, with namely Dadong, seeing an eight-cornered battle. Joining me on the show today to discuss the upcoming Sarawak state elections is Dr. Bridget Welsh, Honorary Research Associate at the University of Nottingham's Asia Research Institute. Welcome to the show, Bridget. How are you doing?
I'm good. Nice to be here. And it's nice to have been able to visit Sarawak.
Before we get into your thoughts on the nominations, let's talk about Sarawak as a whole, their political landscape, because I think a lot of people in the peninsula side of Malaysia aren't very familiar. So when we talk about seats in peninsula Malaysia, Bridget, we often divide it into urban, rural, as well as Malay seats, Chinese seats, and mixed seats. That's generally how people describe it. What is the composition like in Sarawak?
Well, I think if you compare Sarawak to the rest of the country, geography actually matters more. Mm-hmm. You know, now, I mean, Malaysia is 80% urbanized. And so even in the kind of rural seats, there's a kind of connectivity because you have internet and you have roads. But in the case of Sarawak, you don't have that. 64 seats of this, are actually rural, 64 of 82. And when we talk about rural, we're talking about really rural. Mm. So they don't have access to roads. They often will have to take boats. They don't have access to the internet. So when we have these new these SOPs about the election, they do affect the access to information of those in the rural areas. And in the rural areas, in the longhouses, you have, you know, strong personal ties. Everyone knows everyone. Competition in the regard in terms of discussions and debate, because it is a much more personalized and very smaller type of society that allows for different types of less types of debate. So, for example, village headmen have a lot of sway in some of these rural areas. Ethnically, however, we also have a very different composition. And I think, you know, you have 36 major ethnic groups in Sarawak, and people often, you know, they disaggregate them, they simplify them in particular ways. We have, of course, politically very important are the Malay and Melanau communities. These communities, the Melanau in particular, Muslims have had political power in Sarawak for decades. The seats that people often look at in the urban areas are largely Chinese predominant, but even that, you have interesting dynamics within the Chinese community. For example, the powerful group of the Fuchao, for example, compared to other ethnic community, other Chinese ethnic communities within the context of Sarawak. Chinese seats, many of them have continually been competitive historically. The Chinese have been mobilized in very different ways during the confrontation period and about the way that Sarawak got its independence, got its connection into Malaysia. Equally important are largely the Dayak communities, and there's much more. There are lots of Dayak communities in the local areas around Kuching, the Badayu community, and of course up in the northern parts of the state, the Orang Ulu are among the main communities that have very sizable shares and quite a few seats, and they also have different ethnic patterns of voting. So the Malay community, for example, has had the most consistency supporting the BN over time. The Dayak, similarly so, but there's been some changes. But interestingly enough, that's where we see a lot of movement and debate in that community now. The Chinese and the Badayu communities have been traditionally swing voters, especially the Chinese over time. We saw that they swung away from the DAP, for example, in 2016 when they lost seats. The Badayu were very important in the elections in 2016. 2013, 2018. 2018 was also a very important swing state. The Chinese swung back to the Pakatan Harapan at that particular time, although that was not a state election. So the ethnic composition is different, and the way that the communities play and the role that they play in different seats are also different. Right. The other thing to understand about Sarawak is that you don't have as large a number of younger voters compared to other parts of Malaysia. And this is a product of two or three things. The first of which is that many young Sarawakians have to leave the state because they don't have jobs. So therefore, they're not as registered, and they're often outstationed. So we do see very lower voter turnout among younger voters. Second of all, of course, as you know, Undi 18 did not come online for Sarawak's elections, which is a very, I think, a real disservice to Sarawakians. Estimated over 675,000 of voters who would have been automatically registered would have had a chance to be able to vote. And disproportionately, those were younger voters. Younger voters under 30 only make up about 10% of the electorate. And this is really quite starkly different than other parts of Malaysia, in part because many of them are not registered, and of which Undi 18 would have had a big impact. And then finally, of course, you have a very different demographic that is a product of the fact that you also have internal migration within Sarawak to the urban area. So you have more younger voters in places around Kuching as opposed to in places that might be outside into the rural areas, even in places like Cebu.
Right. So with all of that in mind, what issues are Sarawakians paying close attention to? Of course, the issues are going to be diverse given where the individual comes from, whether it's rural, urban, the ethnic lines and all of that. But what, broadly speaking, are Sarawakians paying close attention to? What will they base their vote on?
Well, I think it's, again, here some similarities to the rest of Malaysia, but others that are quite different. So I look at the voting kind of issues in four rubrics, the first of which is the economy. You know, Sarawakians are very conscious of the cost of living. You know, things in Sarawak cost more. That they're focused on economic issues, security and survival. And just like everyone else in Malaysia, the impact of COVID has been quite pronounced from a perspective of livelihood. And we can see that the impact of that among many in Sarawak. And there's some parts of the state that are doing quite well. The oil and gas sectors in Miri and Bintulu are doing quite well. Other parts of the states, such as around Cebu and others, are not as economically vibrant as they used to be in the past because of the resource economy has changed. But if you're living in the rural areas, incomes are extremely low. Sarawak continues to be one of the poorest states in the country. And part of that is because they have very poor infrastructure. You know, the roads just are not, first of all, they're not there, and that the roads they do have are really, they're just a national disgrace. So for many Sarawakians, there is this focus on development and infrastructural projects, which, for people who live in Malacca or who live in Selangor or even in parts of Kelantan, there are not the same needs. And we're talking about water, electricity, internet, access to roads and bridges. These are things that are really, quite starkly absent in many parts of the Sarawakian communities. The second aspect of issues that we look at are the values. Sarawakians tend to be more conservative than a lot of other Malaysians. Right. And this is partly what we see as a, Sarawak is known as the safety deposit for the rest of Malaysia. And there are other reasons which we'll come to in a moment. All right. But the issues of stability, the focus on, being able to deliver, there's a lot of pragmatism in that area. You have strong religious communities, that the church is extremely important, the churches in Sarawak. But at the same time, you also have a much more moderate values. So there's a lot of intermarriage, there's much more accommodation. They look at the issues of Malayization, Malaya as they speak about it, or coming into the values very negatively. They have a sense of unique identity that is being Sarawakian. And that has a different way of accommodating each other in terms of their interactions. And so they don't see the religious issues You know, in the same way, there's not the same base for some of the support for more conservative religious dimensions in terms of Islamic values than there are in the rest of Malaysia. So I think there's different differences in terms of vote dimensions of values. A third important rubric is, of course, the power of nationalism. And we have two really kind of interesting dynamics of nationalism, the first of which is state nationalism, the state-federal relationship. And of all the states in the country, Sarawak has the biggest secessions movement. It is the large, over half the population would like us to have, some argue for even complete independence, but the overwhelming majority want greater autonomy. And this, it explains like the new emergence of new parties such as Parti Bumi Kanyalang, PBK, in that context.
Right.
We can see that the narrative of state nationalism has been there since the, arguably for the last 15 years, 20 years in politics, and it has become an important part of that. Connected to nationalism is a kind of sub-dynamic that is happening, this kind of Dayak nationalism that has emerged, the sense that the Dayak community, while it's very fragmented, it doesn't have very strong leaders, is also being a sense that it's being marginalized within the context of Sarawak. And this, of course, is being added and fueled by also changes that are happening in Borneo as a whole, with, for example, some of the Dayak marginalization that's happening with Indonesia moving its capital to Kalimantan. So we can see this, these sentiments about land, about Dayak identity are really quite strong on the ground. And of course, they will affect some of the local context. And the final rubric that we look at in terms of what voters pay attention to are the issues of personality, of leadership and loyalty and access to resources. The same issues that are quite strong in Sabah, where people need to have a sense of access. And here, there's a perception outside, that Sarawakians are easily bought, and it's clear that resources play a large role in Sarawak's election. But it's also about, the importance of these networks, these connections as part of the managing their survival, especially in the more remote areas that have become very pragmatic and are kind of very pervasive. So these sort of four rubrics, the economy, values, nationalism, and personalities, and they're what those personalities provide in terms of security, are very important at the local level.
Right. Now let's get into the nominations. I mean, what are your overall thoughts on the nominations, Bridget? We are talking about 349 candidates competing for, in 82 constituencies and even 8 cornet battles. What's going on, Bridget?
Well, it's not unexpected. We had similar dynamics in Sabah in the Sabah election last year. You have a lot of people who feel that they can put their hat in the ring. And this, I think, reflects the more democratic practices that are happening in Malaysia. More people are joining the process. I mean, we have undemocratic things happening as well, but the democratic ones are that people feel that they can compete.
Right.
And you've seen, these emergence of these new parties. And this is, Sarawak's politics has changed. Just now, was speaking about the importance of state nationalism. And we can see that, that this has been an issue that the opposition originally used to kind of attack the BN government at that time. And then subsequently, the BN, especially under Adnan Satim, were able to co-opt these issues and to build its own legitimacy by promoting issues of autonomy. And now what we see is that parties are actually, local parties are emerging. We see Parti Sarawak Bersatu, we see Parti Bumi Kanyalang, as I was mentioning earlier, and these reflect the kind of the new kind of localized perceptions about identity and autonomy, and they also contribute to why we have a lot of candidates, and we see a lot of different candidates from different backgrounds. So if we look at the backgrounds of Sarawakian candidates, we see much more greater professionals that are entering the politics. Huh. We're seeing more kind of a wider spectrum of people from different parts of civil society that are coming in. Yes, we still have the kind of dynasty candidates of the sons of the former chief ministers, for example, but we also see quite a lot of new people coming in. And so there might not be as many young candidates in terms of age, but there's a lot of new blood that is trying to come into the political process. And this speaks to another big trend that we see in Malaysia, is that we see a generation transformation and a kind of challenge of the existing elites that is happening on the ground.
Now, Bridget, let's go through some of the parties, especially the major players that will be competing in these elections. Let's start off with GPS, which is perhaps the strongest and biggest party with the most amount of resources and all of that in Sarawak. Now, GPS and Barisan Nasional officially parted ways after Barisan Nasional's defeat at the 2018 general elections. But do voters on the ground see it that way, or do they still see GPS and Barisan Nasional as one entity?
Okay, so let's first of all, a small correction. GPS is not a party, it's a coalition, okay, right? So, right. And it's made up of the most powerful party in that, which is PBB, which is the party that represents largely the Bumiputra, which are Muslims, but it also has some increasingly change over time, increasing Dayak leadership. We see Parti Rakyat PRS, which is where this is where there's going to be more challenge of that particular base. It was largely a Dayak based party. James Mussing used to lead it. He passed away this year. I think some of the traditional PRS seats are more interesting as a competitive base. We have the Progressive Democratic Party and the SUPP. SUPP is predominantly in the Chinese areas, having a long history there and its leadership. So these four parties are quite important and kind of show the kind of ethnic composition and differences within GPS. Mm-hmm. Now, what is interesting is that GPS is trying to distinguish itself. And I was just speaking earlier about the kind of rising state nationalism. So the GPS, by becoming a kind of non-BN, is an extension of saying we're not the federal government, we're our own. All right. And so they're trying to distinguish themselves with their own different logo and so forth. And they are seen to try to couch their legitimacy, both in their performance around COVID and in the economy, as well as in terms of being seen as defending Sarawak's interests. How do voters see this? This way, I think of all the parties and all the coalition, GPS is the most accommodating of the federal government. Although I would say there have been very important steps that GPS has taken in the last few years, including the taxes, taking Petronas to court and others, and getting a state tax and an additional revenue from the federal government that has allowed it to be kind of reinforced this kind of more autonomy in an image. So Barisan Nasional, it doesn't really now exist the same way. And it never really existed the same way, because they were uniquely Sarawakian parties. But now there's more distinction. And I think where the contest for GPS is about the leadership of its current leader, Abang Johari. And I think what's interesting for him is that he, in a sense, he's competing against his predecessor, Adinan Satim, who was extremely right. popular. He had a lot of legitimacy. And what we've seen as Abang Joh has been in office is that he spent a lot of the reserves of the money in Sarawak, over 15 billion. Sarawak has, fortunately, has kept some of its reserves. And he was trying very hard to distinguish himself from Adinan, but now in the last few months, and he's now tried to go back to that. But there's been some questions about his leadership in terms of digitalization and some uneven delivery. But GPS is strong. It's strong because it has delivered for many people. And Abang Joh has had a long time, even longer than expected time, to work to try to build his base, especially among the traditional seats. Especially among PBB, where, yes, there are tensions in that party, but those tensions will play out after the election, not before the election.
On the show with me today is Dr. Bridget Welsh, Honorary Research Associate at the University of Nottingham's Asia Research Institute. After the break, we continue our deep dive into the upcoming Sarawak state elections. We'll be back with more on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashan Johan, and on the show with me today is Dr. Bridget Welsh, Honorary Research Associate at the University of Nottingham's Asia Research Institute, and we're doing a deep dive into the upcoming Sarawak state elections. So, Bridget, I'm wondering, because GPS is not officially part of Barisan Nasional anymore, I mean, they are close allies and things like that, and they accommodate, they are the most accommodating to the federal government, like you mentioned. But because they're not officially a part of BN anymore, is there a chance? I mean, there's always a chance, but how, I'm wondering, is there like now, quote-unquote progressives who would have otherwise voted for the opposition, Pakatan Harapan or some other non-GPS based party, would they now say, okay, because they're not part of BN anymore, I can now consider voting for them? Is there situations like that going on the ground?
Not so much. So I think the thing is to start from the very beginning, right, is that what it means to be progressive in Sarawak is very different than what it means in Semenanjung in Malaya.
Right.
All right. So to be progressive is often to kind of, there's a spectrum now on the issues of secessionism or independence, right? This is the kind of really very important fault line within Sarawak politics. And of course, there are also different views on race and religion, which of course, you know, those Sarawakians don't think about race and religion quite the same way that we see in other parts of Malaysia. So there isn't the same kind of progressive, wanting kind of a more, you know, open democratic process to the same degree as we find in the rest of Malaysia. Even if you compare Sarawak with Sabah, it is a more conservative place. But, you know, there have been calls historically on issues of corruption and reform. Keep in mind, it was in the 2011 election that was really an election that went against Taib Mahmud in that poll, that there was, the issues of corruption were very, very serious in that campaign. And I think we saw similar responses why Sarawakians were unexpectedly against BN in 2018. They were a lot of victories there because of the concerns about corruption and particularly the legacy of Najib's 1MDB scandal. So, yes, there are different kind of fault lines, but whether or not they kind of translate in terms of opening up more space, I think they're going to do so in very different ways, aka, you know, on the state nationalism issues. I don't think the questions about corruption and the issues about kind of having more freedoms have the same, and even the types of reform have the same traction, because many Sarawakians are very disappointed with what happened during Pakatan Harapan, and there is a sense of cynicism about the ability to reform the system, which is more inarguably even more persuasive in some parts than especially among younger urban voters, because there's a sense of disappointment than compared to parts of what happened in the rest of Malaysia.
Right. And on that similar note, then, I guess we got to address something that is on a lot of people's minds these days, whenever, especially when it comes to election time, but just general, and that is former Prime Minister Najib Razak. How much of, when he was campaigning around Melaka and all, people talked about it a lot, you know, how is that going to impact UMNO's popularity? Is it going to bring in, is he going to be a pull factor, or is he going to, you know, push people away from voting from UMNO and things like that? What about, in Sarawak, would the fact that Najib, once again, just very recently, just yesterday, he was found, even in the Court of Appeal, they said that, no, he's a guilty man, and now he's trying to appeal to the federal court and all of that. Would any of this put a dent on GPS's popularity? Or does it, like you said, Sarawak is just focused on other issues, so this will not really play that much of a factor?
Well, I think, you know, his conviction has stood so far in the appeal process. And I think, I think many Sarawakians, as are many Malaysians, are very pleased with that. But I think that whether or not that translates into kind of the localized kind of state election dimensions, I would probably say no. I mean, in some ways, Najib, because he did provide more resources for parts of Sarawak during his tenure, he has a mixed popularity. There are people who hate him, and there are other people who are a little bit more open towards him. But I think that he himself doesn't have as much traction. But someone like Mahathir, by point of comparison, you know, Mahathir still provokes strong reactions just from Sarawakians.
Right.
And Mahathir, you know, because he had a very strong, close relationship with Tai Mahmud. And what happened during Pakatan Harapan's 22 months in power is that Mahathir did not make adequate changes to address the empowerment and the concerns of Sarawakians. And I think that a lot of the promises that were made were seen to be not delivered. And this, of course, in turn, especially impacts DAP in the urban areas. So what we see is a situation where when we compare Najib to Mahathir, Mahathir is a bit more of a bit more baggage compared to Najib. Although Najib, right now, and I think this is true in Malacca and others, people aren't really caring about Najib. What they're caring about are ordinary livelihoods, the impact of COVID, the survival mechanisms. And so politicians can keep using these issues of the past when people are concerned about the present and the future. Mm-hmm. And I think, this is where GPS has more of an advantage because they have been trying to address the issues of COVID. And they've done quite a good job among COVID. You know, they have the vaccine rollout was very quick, of course, with the support of the federal government for that. But it was Sinovac, which makes, I think, to a certain degree, some questions about effectiveness. But Sinovac was quite popular in Sarawak. It has among the lowest deaths in the country, even though, of course, there are some concerns about case numbers, especially most recently. But I think, you know, that's a part of the here and now. Compared to looking at things like, you know, the very distant issue of whether or not Najib is going to go to trial. People are concerned about whether or not they're going to survive and whether or not the boosters are going to arrive and also how are they going to navigate the economic situation.
Certainly. Now, one last question about GPS before we switch gears to Pakatan Harapan side. You brought up earlier that Sarawakians, their view about race and religion and even religious issues and all, they are more moderate and they look at things from a completely different prism than most Malaysians on the west side of the country. And with that in mind, right, unlike pre-GE14, where PAS and Barisan Nasional were on completely opposite sides, they have now since formed a loose alliance. They have a love-hate relationship going on. We don't really know how close it's changing every week. But the fact is, they are at least when it comes to post-elections coalitions and all, they are willing to work with Barisan Nasional. They are a loose ally of Barisan Nasional. Is the GPS support base concerned about this at all?
Concerned about PAS, do you mean?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I think, you know, it is noteworthy that PAS is not part of the GPS, and even the alliance, that they're contesting only in one seat, in the seat that they felt that they have the best chances of winning in Betting Maro. My sense is that the GPS is working hard to see if they're distant and keep away from PAS in this context. But I do think that the electorate is our concerns about issues of religion, and those still kind of permeate the concerns about the federal government. And they also, you know, are used subtly as a criticism of GPS in terms of the alliances. And I expect as the campaign evolves, those issues will continue to permeate because GPS is seen as too close in helping to empower PAS. But for, you know, these issues are important, but they don't, trump the issues of the economy or the concerns on the ground, which give GPS a greater advantage. They do matter, I think, more among traditional opposition voters, such as the Chinese community, and they do matter among some of the church communities in some of the more rural and semi-rural seats. My sense is, however, is that GPS will probably work hard to try to distance, by PAS only choosing one seat, they're trying to minimize the damage of that relationship by focusing its energies in a concentrated way.
Right. Now, let's move on to Pakatan Harapan, the opposition. I guess, the big question that I want to ask you about Pakatan Harapan is, were they popular in Sarawak during their 22 months in power? Because just by gauging sentiments on social media and whatnot, it seems like, very mixed reviews for Pakatan Harapan. How were they while they were the ruling, while they were in government? Were they popular in Sarawak, and how has their popularity either increased or decreased since then?
So we need to look at sort of three or four different areas. So the first area, so I would say generally Pakatan Harapan did not garner the popularity that it received in GE 14 in terms of, keep in mind, without the Sarawak seats, there would have been no federal government for Pakatan Harapan. But of course, people seem to have forgot that when they got into office, right? Sarawak seats were part of the pivotal change, right? But and there were a lot of high expectations among Sarawakians. But of course, I've mentioned earlier the Mahathir factor. Mahathir never really was willing to engage in any meaningful reform of creating autonomy. And he was also had the baggage of being connected to Taib Mahmud. But we also see, I think what people don't appreciate is that during Pakatan Harapan, it was associated for many poorer people and more vulnerable communities as a period of austerity. So, many people voted against the Najib government because of high cost of living. And of course, connected to that were issues of corruption and others. But, largely because Najib's government, for the impact on the ground was quite harsh for many people. It was tied especially to the poor implementation of the GST. But what we see is that, when Pakatan Harapan came into government, they began to cut many of the programs, many of these programs that were critical for people who are more vulnerable. And so, the economy did not necessarily improve to the extent that there was this sort of economic legitimacy that Pakatan Harapan could gain. At the same time, it was cutting supports to the social safety net. So while this was very impactful in places like Malacca, I would say it was also impactful in the context of Sarawak. And I think that we can see that particular element. Also, Pakatan Harapan leaders in Sarawak made a lot of promises about independence, about trying to shift the not independence but autonomy and shift the kind of resource allocation and to open up docks and discussions. And those, in terms of the issues of federal state relations, were not seen to gain that much traction. And of course, there was also a very difficult relationship between Pakatan Harapan leaders at the federal level and GPS leaders. Often the personnel antagonism spilled over into how things worked on the ground. And so therefore, this also contributed to a kind of sense of mixed perceptions among Sarawakians about how they could perceive Pakatan Harapan.
Let's look at the component parties of Pakatan Harapan, starting with DAP. DAP, particularly Lim Guan Eng, has at times come across as rather antagonistic, not just towards GPS, but sometimes seemingly even towards Sarawakian voters, or questioning their voting choices in a rather perhaps unfair way, some would say. Now, with that in mind, will DAP be able to retain their seats in Sarawak, especially considering that, you know, even in Malacca, they lost four of their, they had eight seats and then they lost four in the recent state elections. Will they be able to retain their seats in Sarawak this time around, or, you know, perhaps even win even more?
Well, first of all, let me start by answering this question by saying that a lot of people in Malaya or in Peninsula Malaysia, and I use the Malaya term as what people talk about it, and I think that's the phrase that they use, but it is also pejorative from the perspective of Sarawakians towards Peninsula Malaysia. A lot of people in Peninsula Malaysia are extremely pejorative to Sarawakian voters, especially to those in the rural areas.
Right.
And I think that, you know, this is, I think it does a tremendous disservice. And it feeds a lot of resentments, you know, and it does a disservice to Sarawakians in the sense that I think that they vote pragmatically, they vote, I think, in an ever more informed way, and then I think is given credit. And I think that, I think people don't recognize that the choices that they're making are very much a product of the context that they live in, you know, and when they make choices about development, it's because there's a lack of development of which, you know, people in Peninsula Malaysia have not really drawn attention to, for example. So when, you know, you have someone like Gwaneng who came in to Sarawak, and, you know, you had a long, you know, opposition type of dynamic. And I think one of the features of Pakatan Harapan is they still operated as if they were opposition when they were in government. So there was kind of, you know, there wasn't personal antagonism comments that were made. I think, you know, arguably this type of relationship really underscored one of the reasons why GPS was not able to be part of an alliance, and what happened with the Sheraton move and others when things were moving in a particular direction, or when there was even a possibility of a new government forming that happened in August of this year, you know, GPS stayed loyal to BN or PN in that context because of these personal kind of antagonistic relationships. And I think, you know, it has to do with the way that opposition politics more generally had to Sarawak, but it also had to do with the way opposition politics operates in Sarawak. So the leadership, the DAP leadership in Sarawak, led by YB Chong, was quite, you know, antagonistic. It's confrontational. And of course, that also created a kind of a sense of antagonism. Now, of this, you know, it lost seats in 2016. But the voting pattern in 2018 was quite significant, that if the state election had been held then, they would have won seats back. Right. Now they're contesting 26 seats. I think that they've got seven. I think that there's a good chance that they're going to face some problems in some of the seats that they have, for the same reasons that Malacca was also a problem. So first of all, you have lower voter turnout. And second of all, you have a sense of a decline of support among young people. But those, it's a question of whether or not they can galvanize their support and their traditional base. And I think that among the 30-year-olds and 40-year-olds generations, I think they're going to face a bit more of a reckoning. And so there are a couple things that are going on here. First of all, YB Chong himself was seen as, you know, he was given an appointment in the Mahathir government, and he himself was not seen as being delivered as much. He faces a bit more less popularity than he had before. The DAP has chosen to contest in a very conservative way, which is very un-DAP like. Usually DAP, what it chooses to do is to field its strongest people in the more competitive seats. Here what we see is that its incumbents are in the safer seats.
Right.
We're also seeing a situation where many of the incumbents have been around in the key core seats that they have. And so there's, you know, they don't have the same income. They actually have a bit of incumbency baggage. But where the interesting contests are where they have new people, and they fielded a lot of new people and majority of new people, but the seats that they have are mostly held by the incumbents, and there's a more kind of conservative positioning on that. I think that, you know, those those contests are going to be interesting. So, for example, I'm looking at the seat of Batukawa, where YB Kelvin is actually contesting against Dr. Sim, who is extraordinarily popular and helped lead the COVID programs in Sarawak, but it's a competitive seat. And almost all of the seats in Sarawak among the Chinese areas are now competitive seats. And so I think it's going to be, you know, it's difficult because DAP has a problem of trying to find the political narrative. So a lot of it's going to come down to issues of personality and some of the fragmented competition that we're seeing in many of these seats, like Dudong you mentioned earlier, which is in the near the Cebu area. And I think it, you know, part of what we saw in Malacca and what we're definitely going to see even more enhanced in Sarawak is that the SOPs really negatively affect the campaign.
Right.
So, you know, because campaigning in Sarawak is extremely local. Part of this is the resources people talk about, the patronage and the vote buying and so forth. But part of it is also that people in Sarawak is not a highly populated place. Everyone, people know each other. Personal relationships matter. Face-to-face interactions still matter in politics. And I think by affecting and stopping this type of campaigning, I think it's going to really significantly disadvantage the opposition. And I think of especially where the Chirama and the moods that we would see in Kuching and in Cebu and to a certain degree also in Miri were quite powerful. You know, it was the campaign moods that affected the 2011 election, for example, that were really quite pronounced in the context of making a shift in favor of DAP. They don't have that in this particular contest.
Now, talking about, you know, Harapan's component parties, PKR's popularity, at least, you know, in the peninsula, is clearly dropping, as evident from the Malacca state election results. They have a lot of work to do to see where they went wrong, how they can improve, and all of that. Sarawak is, of course, a different beast, but should they, you know, PKR be looking at their Malacca state elections and, you know, be worried heading into the Sarawak state elections?
Of course, I might, you know, I think that they are going to face significant problems in terms of PKR always makes strategic choices, that are, I think, very challenging in the context of Sarawak. They try to contest in many, many areas. And, you know, it costs a lot more money to contest in Sarawak because you have to pay for boats and other things. The logistics are just, you know, are much more expensive. But, you know, they've announced, their candidate lists, right? They have some quite important local personalities in some of the contests, but you know, my sense is that they've overextended. You know, they've contested in 27 seats, and I think that they're, you know, we're going to see a big loss for PKR overall, because in terms of the number of the seats that they contested. But that has always been the case in the context of Sarawak. And the big challenge is that it doesn't have local leadership. And of course, it lost its leadership when Barbian left and is now part of PSB. But I think that what we see is a situation where it's still trying to find its footing. And of course, Anwar has been already playing a very prominent role here. So, I think that we're going to see considerable losses for PKR in the coming election.
All right. And I also want to ask you a question about Amana, because earlier you brought up, you know, how GPS is trying to distance itself from PAS because of religious issues and all of that, right? There is a branding side of things in terms of how GPS wants to position itself. Now, Amana is, of course, not, a party like PAS at all. Amana is more moderate Islam and all of that, but they are undeniably an Islamic based party. That is their ideology. Will that play into the minds of Sarawakians, especially in the constituencies in which Amana is running at, or will they just see it as, you know, Amanah, PKR, DAP, you know, it's all Pakatan Harapan, doesn't matter. I'll just cast my vote for Pakatan Harapan.
I would say it's very weak institutionally, even weaker than PKR, as of all the different component parties. And I think that this has been systemic over the years. Amanah has not performed well in terms of Sarawak's elections. But it has, you know, I think it has, it'll be interesting to see, you know, of the 8 seats that it's contested, you know, whether or not it has some of its local candidates gain ground. You know, I think it's a very big uphill battle for Amanah from an electoral point of view. You know, they're a peninsula-based party. They have the Islamist issues, but at the same time, they have they've tried to pick some local candidates that they think will have traction. But I think it's going to be much more challenging for them.
All right. Okay, Bridget, as we wrap our conversation up today, final thoughts and also predictions. Who do you think will you know, come out, you know, in this 82-seat battle? Who will end up victorious at the Sarawak state elections? Is it going to be GPS or Pakatan Harapan? What do you think?
So I will predict, which I think is quite an easy prediction at this point, that GPS will form the government.
Right.
In part because I think if we look at the 82 seats, you know, no more than a third of them are competitive. I think what to me is interesting is not who forms the government in Sarawak, because that's pretty much been established. I think what's interesting are how people adapt to the changing nature of Sarawak politics, the emergence of new local-based parties, the kind of the escalation and the tensions over the federal-state relationship, the kind of the recalibration of Pakatan Harapan, if it can try to find a way to survive this particular election and to come out of it stronger than it did in Melaka. I think that it's right now it has the potential of getting another battering in that context. And the question is, you know, what narratives they try to articulate. My sense is that they don't clearly have a clear positioning. And of course, a lot of this comes down to the personalities on the local level because of the elections being very personal. But I think, you know, Sarawak elections will offer a kind of a different type of lens than Melaka did to what we will see as elections move forward. And, you know, I'm curious to see how, in particular, younger voters are working and how the Dayak communities are going to see whether or not they're going to swing and change. So the Chinese, the Bidayu, and the Dayaks are the ones that I'm looking at in particular.
On that note, Bridget, thank you so much for joining me today.
Most welcome.
I've been speaking with Dr. Bridget Welsh. She's an honorary research associate at the University of Nottingham's Asia Research Institute. If you missed any part of our conversation on the upcoming Sarawak 2021 state elections, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Dashan Johan, and this has been Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.